How many of you read New Horizons? Did you read the articles this month? Good. Because I don't usually get one published, but Danny Olinger asked me to reduce 7,000 words to 2,300. Boy, it was not easy, I'll tell you. For the talkative, it's not easy to reduce those words. So, in any case, we did it. No, that wasn't reduced. That was originally, it was a chapter in a book called, and I mentioned this when we were looking at the Waters book on how Jesus runs his church, but it was a chapter in a book called Order in the Offices. So what I've done recently is, because Danny asked me to reduce that for New Horizons, I went ahead and did that. It was actually more work than writing the original article. And then I went back and I revised the original because there were some things that I wanted to change, add a little bit to, and so if you look in Ordained Servant online this month and next month, you'll see the two parts of that one article that's been expanded a little bit. And if you're interested in following up on this topic, it was one of the things that I found. I was very intrigued by church government and worship back in the early days, in the first decade of my ministry. So I spent a lot of time reading and studying on this topic. And so this is from those days. But the title is something, it's a topic that intrigues me always, which is the democratic ideal in our culture, oftentimes referred to as egalitarianism. I'll use that word as synonymous with the democratic ideal, which is not a political system. Actually, to refer to our political system properly, it is a constitutional republic. It's not a democracy, but we don't take as much care with words as we ought to, and so we refer generally to our system as a democracy. Okay, generically it is, but it's a constitutional republic, a very good form of government, at least one of the best among all the bad systems of the world. But it's a bad system, said Winston Churchill, but it's so much better than all the rest, so we ought to like constitutional republicanism. Of course, they have a little different version over there in the UK. But I'm talking here not about a political system, but rather about a mindset, an ideal. So democratic has become a catchword in our culture. And so we want to go back and look at where does this idea of egalitarianism come from, and how has it affected the way that we view the government of the church, in particular church office, minister, elder, deacon. And so we need to think of it in terms of democracy. Oftentimes we see it referred to in very, very narcissistic or self-oriented ways in our culture. I have my rights. My opinion's as important as anyone's or as yours. I may believe what I like, and I may do what I like as long as it doesn't hurt anyone. So these would be very popular ways in which the negative part of this cultural ideal of democratic spirit ends up revealing itself to us. And what it tends to do, of course, is elevate the authority of man, and usually my authority, over God's authority. That is its essential tendency and something which we ought to be alert to. And, of course, if you read history, historians are going to say this is rooted in the Enlightenment, and we can see loads of examples of, and we'll look at those in a minute, especially in terms of the Enlightenment in its American manifestation. You can see that ideal in spades. There was a clear, if you look in the revolution in France, they wanted to wipe the slate of history clean, sort of like Le Corbusier wanted to do in architecture. This was one of the conceits of the Enlightenment, is that we wipe history clean, we're going to start over, and boy, we're going to do so much better job than all these slobs in the past. That is a conceit that led to, well, the guillotine, for one, and a lot of other awful things. But it didn't start with the Enlightenment. The first Enlightenment was actually in Eden, when Eve's and then Adam's eyes were opened to their rebellion, to what they had done by choosing to pick of the forbidden fruit. And so the essence of the egalitarian spirit then is not equality, that's the way it presents itself, but autonomy. That is to say that man is in charge, not God. And that, of course, goes right back to Genesis chapter 3. Interestingly, if you look at the idea of office in the Bible, the idea of office in the Bible, going right back to God's original creation of Adam and Eve, is that they were to be servants or vicegerents of the Lord. And they were to use their being made in his image to bring him glory and to enjoy the world in which he had created them. And so when Adam forsook his office, he really became the first egalitarian and started egalitarianism. And it's had different manifestations throughout history. If you read one of the most famous of the proponents and the one that stirred it up the most of the American Revolution was Thomas Paine. How many have read anything of Thomas Paine? You maybe had to. You've at least seen some quotes of his in history books and that kind of thing. Well, he was a prolific writer. He was a very brilliant man. He was also a very accomplished man. He was a man like most of those founding era people of many accomplishments. But he wrote a book called The Age of Reason, and he also said, "My own mind is my own church." He couldn't say it more plainly. And we see this. This is why church membership, the idea of church membership, the idea of church office is almost completely foreign in American culture. We don't get it. We don't understand it because of statements like this that really were he helped to form our consciousness, but he also was reflecting what was going on in the time of our founding era. And in fact, his Age of Reason, that's not where this quote comes from, I don't believe. It might have been. But in any case, his Age of Reason is a virulent attack on historic Christianity. I mean, it's just down and dirty. Otherwise, he wrote some things that were pretty interesting as well, so we shouldn't just write him off, but we should definitely understand that he was the consummate egalitarian. And then we have Ben Franklin, more popular person in terms of American culture. We all know loads of his little moral maxims, which are in themselves quite helpful. Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. I've actually attained a lot more wisdom staying up late after the kids were gotten to bed and reading. But anyway, this is a good idea that you're to be diligent. He was another one of these people that was a man of many, many talents. But the ethical principles of the Bible were meant to serve the republic. Okay, they were meant to serve man. The idea that God was in charge was really foreign to the mentality of Ben Franklin. He was a utilitarian, and so were many in the day and age of the founding. They were deists, which puts God at a distance theologically, and they were utilitarians. The Bible is very important. The Ten Commandments especially, and especially the latter six of those Ten Commandments, because if people don't steal, if they maintain the family, if they don't murder, the republic will be a better place to live. And so you have comments like that. This republic can't survive if we don't believe and obey the Ten Commandments. I think it was Madison that said that famously. Was he a believer? Not necessarily. In fact, it's very difficult because there's not a lot written by the founders to tell us of their religious convictions, though they invoke God continuously. And it's not to say that there weren't some serious Christians during the founding era that were in leadership positions. But the fact is that this idea of utilitarianism and egalitarianism was there rife throughout the culture of that era. Then in the 19th century, Romanticism is often seen as a reaction against the Enlightenment and, of course, the whole Industrial Revolution, where machines were being created that did all kinds of amazing things. So the reaction to this, the railroad, for example, Washington Irving, I can remember when, if you've ever been to his beautiful little romantic cottage, it's a 12-room cottage, but it's a lovely little home right there on the Hudson. It overlooks the Tappan Sea, where the Tappan Sea Bridge, it's the Tappan Sea. It's like a small ocean in size. And when the railroad came through, oh, he deplored it. He hated the railroad. We romanticize the railroad because we have the jet plane and that sort of thing. But The Romantics reacted against the Enlightenment and its one of its most obvious manifestations, which was the Industrial Revolution. And so it's oftentimes thought we've got the Enlightenment, we've got Romanticism, they were opposed to one another, but they really are two children of the same parents, the same parent of egalitarianism. And so we have Walt Whitman, his famous Song of Myself. He says, I celebrate what? God? America? No, myself. He celebrates himself. This is not a new sentiment now in the 21st century in American culture. And so new technologies, of course, just continued to give expression to egalitarianism in our culture. It's a very interesting thing. How many of you use Wikipedia? Everyone has to use Wikipedia because it's the first thing that comes up usually if you punch in a name or a question. So I just had a very interesting and unhappy encounter with Wikipedia. You go and look at what the Orthodox Presbyterian Church article says, and it's been altered since December 26th, so this is very recent corruption of that article. I don't know who first put it up there, but they added a section, somebody did, on politics and race. It's an editorial. It's not an encyclopedia article. It's just horrific what they did. And I'm going to work like crazy to try and get that changed. But this is egalitarianism. Everyone can get their opinion in there. And guess who wins? The loudest voice, the one who spends the most time working on these articles, whether they're of good quality or not. Now, there are many very good quality articles in Wikipedia. But if we don't know anything about the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, how on earth would we know? And those of us who are in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church do know, and I happen to know that this article in one section quotes something that I just wrote on this very topic out of context. This is not a new thing, but it's one of the evils that egalitarianism can lead to, and one of the evils that with technology it simply has much more power to express itself. Let me ask if there are questions. There are four. I have four sections to this little talk. Jen and then Bill. We tend to think is that everyone is equal. That's the idea. We're all equal. Of course, even in our Constitution and in the Declaration, we're equal before the law. We're not equal in terms of our looks, our position in life, our wealth, even though presently there are some that would like to make us all equal in wealth. But that ideal is there, that we are all equal, and therefore we all have a right to our own opinions. So what I'm doing is by saying that autonomy is more the essence of egalitarianism, is I'm going down to what's underneath that, the talk about equality. Bill? That's a famous relationship between George Whitefield and Ben Franklin. And Franklin was he loved to listen to sermons. And he oftentimes had very good insights into bad sermons. That the guy said, hey, this man says the same four applications every single week, 5-6 weeks in a row. And it has nothing to do with the text. But then with Whitefield, the opposite. He respected his rhetorical abilities. And I think he's the one that said that he was the only person he knew that could say Mesopotamia and make a man weep. So, interesting power of rhetoric. But the effects of that on church office is what we want to look at briefly next. And so during the Great Awakening, which my friend Daryl Hart calls the not-so-great awakening, he's, you know, those historian, academic historians, you got to watch out for them. But I think he has a point that we tend to glorify the revival, the people that became real Christians during that time. But the anti-intellectualism and the anti-clericalism were a dangerous influence in the American church and in American life. And so the revivalist, as two historians, Alan Heimert and Perry Miller, in their book called The Great Awakening, say that it was a force battering at the ecclesiastical structure. So revivalism, especially within Presbyterianism, it was constantly fighting against everything that I've been teaching over in From the Waters book. So the whole idea of office and of intellect are all just denigrated by especially the extreme revivalists. And I took a quote from the larger article. I wanted to read this to you. It's not in the New Horizons article. But one revivalist named Herman Husband says, "My capacity is not below them of the first and greatest magnitude." And another revivalist claimed that there are abler divines in the awakening than either Luther or Calvin. So you have that kind of quote. And there's actually one man named James Davenport. His repentance during the awakening consisted of burning his books and his clerical garb. And, of course, we don't have clerical garb, but you get the point there, is that all you needed to do is have an experience of God's grace, and that qualified you to be a minister. So education and all the rest of it, the idea of office, were out the window. And, of course, what we also observe, though, is that Presbyterianism tended to endure better, especially than hierarchical churches like Episcopalianism or Methodism. And the reason it endured better is because there is spiritual power and authority in the laity of the church. You have elders and deacons. And so power is beautifully dispersed. It's not the voice and authority of simply one individual. And because the ruling elder has always played a prominent part in Presbyterianism, we've been able to stand ground better than, not completely, but better than other churches against the worst parts of egalitarianism. And so we see this in the modern world now. One of the ways, you know, I've been always analyzing this view. I'll never forget the first time that someone said to me, how come the minister, they didn't say me, but of course I was implicated, how come the minister gets to be on stage, the only one on stage every Sunday? I thought, wow, that's such an interesting way of framing that statement. On stage. That is not a stage. But that's the way we think of it. Why do we think of it as a stage? Because that's the way our culture functions. And everyone, therefore, wants to be a star on American Idol. Everyone wants to be the greatest teen singer that the world has ever seen. That's egalitarianism. Now, that may be fine in its place, though I have problems with that in and of itself. But the fact is that now the idea of being in a position of authority is connected more with personal aggrandizement than it is with service. And so that's where we are. If people view anyone who's on stage being glorified, then, of course, they're going to want to be there too. And so we can see that spirit has just invaded American culture, and celebrity has really replaced the servant in the church as well. And we see this, the mega church. I mean, these are all examples of that spirit expressed ecclesiastically. And so my purpose in writing this article, or these articles, this short one in New Horizons and the longer one in Ordained Servant, is to defend what's known as the three-office view. We went over that, so I'm not going to go into this in great detail. But it's so important, and this maybe is just an opportunity to reinforce the essence of what I'm trying to say based on our Presbyterian and biblical tradition, is that the strict two-office view really gives in to egalitarianism. And a three-office view tends to protect us against egalitarianism. Now, when I've been out in churches and I've taught on this subject, one of the things I've found is sometimes there are wounded elders out there. And they've been wounded because they've been in a church where the minister said, it's my way or the highway. And, of course, there have been elders like that in the church as well who've been dominant on a session. And so ministers tend to last in those churches for about 2 or 3 years, and then they're gone. So it can work both ways, because sin is sin, no matter who is exercising it or exhibiting it. And so we have to keep in mind that there can be an abuse. By having the right structure, you're not going to solve the problem. It helps, but you've got to have men in those offices who are learning. We never get completely there, but are learning to be servants of the Lord, and who really strongly reject the idea of celebrity. So the distinction between pastor and ruling elder is especially important, because it really protects us against egalitarianism. And it's interesting that, ironically, egalitarianism ends up elevating the very people that it seeks to level. So it's interesting that it works just the opposite way. If you want to go back and read about the French Revolution, you see that in spades, is that when everyone's leveled, the loudest, strongest, most domineering personalities just take over the field. And that's such a dangerous, dangerous thing. Charles Hodge said of the two-office view, and I remember, a strict two-office view really does not exist in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, because our form of government is three-office. It has tremendous respect for both the ruling elder and for the minister of the word, as well as the deacon. And so the distinction is very clear there. So people that say we're two-and-a-half office are really, they're saying, well, that elders and ministers are two functions of the same office, but they are distinct. And so I've never met an elder or a minister or anyone who held this two-and-a-half office view who believed that ministers shouldn't go to seminary or that all elders should go to seminary. So we really are three office. But a pure two-office view says that there's really no essential distinction between ministers and elders. It's more of a pragmatic matter of who can do it. Maybe we can't afford to pay for someone. So like the Plymouth Brethren, it's basically anyone who gets up and wants to teach from the Bible. It has to be a man, but there's no such thing as office in those circles. And so that's a strict two-office view. We don't hold to that at all. So Hodge says this. He says, this doctrine is therefore completely revolutionary. It deprives the people of all substantive power. The legislative, judicial, and executive power, according to our system, is in church courts. And if these courts are to be composed entirely of clergymen and are close, self-perpetuating bodies, then we have, or we should have, as complete a clerical domination as the world has ever seen. So he's saying if there are just two offices, if you just have deacons and elders, and the elders are the clerics, you're not going to have anything in between that will represent the people of the congregation. And so what do we do? And we've been over this. If you want to go back and listen to the lectures from Waters, you can hear all the details of the distinction between the two. But what do we do about the restoration of office? Bill, did you have a question or comment? Yeah, the teaching elder and ruling elder, and that's a good distinction. Yes, you could say minister, elder, and deacon, or you could say teaching elder, ruling elder, and deacon. And we're going to get to that actually in a minute. You'll see a distinction that is made, which is very interesting. So this is under the third heading of the restoration of office. How do we restore this understanding? Well, the point at issue actually is there a distinction in the Bible? This would be where we ought to finally make the decision in the exegetical, you know, the opening of the New Testament. Is there a distinction between minister and elder? And so what we want to understand, as Ed Clowney, he was actually a professor of mine and has written a lot of very helpful material on Presbyterianism. He says that if the presbyter is used uniformly, the word presbyter, okay, for elder, is used uniformly in the New Testament to refer to a single office, then we can't make a distinction between pastor and elder, or minister and elder. We can't make that distinction if that word is uniformly used of one office. But then, as Clowney says, in 1 Timothy 5:17, those who engage and rule are distinguished from those who labor in the word and doctrine. Again, the fact that both groups can be called presbyteroi, meaning presbyters or elders, by no means demonstrates that their office is identical. So that's why the terminology of teaching elder or ruling elder is, those are acceptable labels for the office based on what the Bible says, because the two offices are often referred to by the one word, presbyter or elder. And the same, of course, is true, as we pointed out, I gave a bunch of examples of this, that Jesus is referred to as a deacon, and Paul is referred to as a deacon. So you know, we understand that there is a fluidity to these words referring generally to aspects of different offices. And so the idea of the presbyter is true. What the word presbyter means is it's true of both the ruling elder and the teaching elder. So either any of those, I mean, there are a number of different terms for each office that are legitimate, although I think deacon is pretty much universally, that's what we use for the office of deacon. But elders are referred to as deacons, and so are apostles, as we said in the New Testament. And so, once you go, and let me just read 1 Timothy 5:17, which is a real important verse for Presbyterians, along with of course, Acts 15. Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. So you have a clear distinction. And by the way, double honor there is remuneration. Okay, so Paul is being very practical in writing to Timothy because he realizes that Timothy and his generation of evangelists are planting churches that they're going to be based on the enduring pattern beyond the apostolic age. Charlie? The question is, what would you say to someone who would just say there are two different roles of the same office? And that's what 1 Timothy 5:17 it says. And, of course, that's what the two-and-a-half office view is going to want to say. It certainly doesn't support a two-office view, but those with the two-and-a-half office view want to say that. I think the problem is that when you put this in the context of all else that's said in the New Testament, then you have a problem. But it would be worth, if you want to look more at both a few contemporary articles as well as some of our historical articles, especially by Thomas Smythe and also Charles Hodge, that book, which I think we still have a copy or two of on the book table, Order in the Offices, is an excellent defense of the three-office view. And it addresses some of these exegetical questions in a detailed way. But good question, Charlie. Yes, Ginny? The question is, does this verse imply that ruling elders, too, are due remuneration, just that those who labor in the word and doctrine are double honor? I wouldn't want to take that too literally to say that the ruling elders ought to get a salary and then the minister ought to get twice that amount. There are examples. I know one example in Franklin Square, New York, where elders, they're retired men, one who is actually a police detective in the New York City Police Department, and he's an elder full-time working with Pastor Shishko, and he's remunerated. How much, I don't know. He's, of course, retired and has a pension and Social Security, but he is remunerated, and there have been others as well. The problem in our churches, of course, is that usually ruling elders are full-time employed in a profession, so they not only don't need to, but could not afford to take the time or to do the work that would require remuneration. And then also, our churches tend to be just way too small to do that. But actually, there was a time when Elder Graves was remunerated in a very small way, but still he was remunerated for doing work with me, doing visitation and counseling and other things. So that certainly would be one possible practical application. Jen? The question has to do with if everyone in the church agrees with this way of church governance and is, as you put it, appropriately deferential to the authority of elders and ministers, then how is it that we can make sure that there is good communication between the two, the congregants and those in office? And first of all, I would say that that's what we work at that. There should be, in other words, if I take Philippians 2 seriously, then I have respect for what everyone would bring to the table. But it doesn't mean that I have to agree. In other words, being respectful of opinions and truly listening to them means taking them seriously and trying to really understand what someone is saying. And then, of course, a session, a minister have to come to decisions about, I mean, if something, let's say a policy is being proposed, we have to come to a decision that we think is biblical and is best for the congregation. Now, there are many decisions that we make, of course, that don't have a particular biblical warrant one way or the other. And so, you know, times of worship and how you do a whole bunch of different things in the church, they're not necessarily going to have some biblical warrant. But we still have to take the responsibility to come up with decisions. The other thing is that, you know, there's only so many hours in a day or a week, and usually in our small congregations, elders and ministers are way overstretched in terms of their ability to talk with everyone. And so what we tend to do, and this isn't always a good thing, but we tend to listen to people who come and talk to us. So if you come and talk to us, then the elders are going to want to listen carefully. And we hope that people will feel comfortable enough with us that they do. That, you know, if, again, Philippians 2, we're to actually treat others as better than ourselves. The Lord is not asking us to go contrary to fact. I may be smarter than someone else or more educated on a particular topic. The Lord isn't asking me to deny that, but what He is asking me to do is treat them as better than me. And that's not something that I come to by nature, nor anyone who was born in Adam, but it's what elders and ministers need to work towards as an ideal. That's a deep question, but... Well, it's very, I think, important across all of the human world that this be the case. And I know this in terms of employment. I've worked in a number of different offices out there in the world, and so I know that same difference. When working in architecture, you have probably some of the more arrogant people in any profession are in architecture. They think they can redesign the world. Frank Lloyd Wright and Le Corbusier would be two primary examples of that. I worked for a boss at Procon Construction, who was an architect in our architectural division, who was a servant architect. And he said, we're there to serve the client. Now, we know some things about building buildings and designing them that they don't. But we need to make sure that in whatever we do, we're meeting their needs. And for people like Frank Lloyd Wright, their clients were meeting his needs to be the greatest architect in the history of the world. So complete difference. So the same is true out there in the populace. And I think it's a matter of humility. It's a matter of listening carefully. But it also, again, in our egalitarian environment, means that leaders have to lead. And servant leaders have to lead. And it sometimes leads to great suffering, as our Lord Jesus is the most primary example of. And so... You know, it's a hard forums. I mean, are there forums in which people can come and talk? Well, we have session meetings. But you know what? Two of our men get up at 5 o'clock in the morning or earlier, and we can't go on forever. And that ends up being a serious problem. And it's frustrating to me sometimes that there's not enough time to talk. But this is the world we live in, and we just have to try to do the best that we can. So there are many different venues in which we can be aware of concerns. And one of the things that we're doing, for example, this year, and we're going to be announcing it in the elders report, well, if you've read the annual reports, you've already seen this, that we want to know your thoughts, the congregation's thoughts, about what kind of a midweek service would we have and how many people are actually committed to coming. Because the reason that we did away with that years ago is because no one was coming. And so were we doing something wrong? Could we do something differently? Is there just not a possibility of that level of commitment? We don't want to start something that is not going to be a blessing to the congregation as a whole. And so we want to know. So we want input. Now, we're not going to do that at this meeting. I mean, we could talk about this for hours, obviously. But the session wants people to tell us what we might do. There are probably 10 or 12 different options that we might pursue. At the end of the day, however, we have to come up with a decision about this. And some people are going to be unhappy about that. They're not going to agree. They're going to say, well, we should have a midweek meeting and it should be such and such. And we're going to say, no, it's going to be different than that because we believe this is what will serve the congregation best. And that's where leadership has authority that God has given, and we have to go with that. And those who disagree, unless there's something immoral or erroneous doctrinally, People need to submit to that. I have to do this in the presbytery. I have to submit to things that I don't agree with because the presbytery has come to a decision, and I'm part of that body, and we've done it in a biblical way. And unless it's immoral, a problem of ethics or doctrine, then I need to submit and humbly submit myself to it. So, and that's what leadership at every level does. Dads and moms have to do this in the home. And dads, final authority is with them, and they take the hit if they make bad decisions too. So there's a responsibility of leadership in exercising authority that seeks to take all of the ideas and thoughts and situations that need to be addressed into account the best that we can. Having listened well, we have to make a decision. And then, of course, those decisions can be altered down the road as different circumstances arise.